Headlines. Rail passengers in Britain are facing disruption as thousands of train drivers' union members hold a strike over a pay dispute. Russian forces take full control of Pisky, a town on the outskirts of Ukraine's Donetsk region. And China resorts to makeshift hospitals in order to tackle surging COVID cases across the nation. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Industrial strikes in the UK shows no signs of abating amid rising inflation. This time, train drivers in London have walked out of their jobs over pay and working conditions. Members of a British trade union representing train drivers have staged a 24-hour strike. The union has warned more strikes will be called if train companies and the government fail to resolve the problems. Large parts of Britain's train network have been brought to a standstill. British workers in the postal service, ports and telecom companies have already held similar strikes. Households are grappling with record-high inflation coupled with a cost-of-living crisis. Last week, the Bank of England warned inflation could hit 13% by fall. Such woes are mainly blamed on the economic fallout of the Russia-Ukraine war. Household energy bills in Italy are expected to double in the third quarter of 2022 as a consequence of the sanctions on Russia and rising gas prices. Italian families are holding their breath as fears about how they'll be able to cover their costs keep mounting. Max Civelli has more from Rome.
Gas bills in Italy will likely double in cost from October the 1st if gas prices continue to rise this way. The recent announcement by power regulator ARERA has gone utterly unnoticed, with the Italian media focusing on the electoral campaign about a month away from the September 25 national elections. A week ago, the outgoing Italian government unveiled a €17 billion aid package aimed at protecting families from surging energy costs and rising consumer prices. However, ARERA and some energy experts have warned that very little has been done so far to reduce energy consumption in the country.
Italy's highly critical energy situation has been downplayed by politicians and the media. On one side, there is confidence about the country achieving its target of reaching storage levels of 90%, while on the other side, the risk that Russia could altogether stop the flow of gas to Italy has been underplayed.
Gas is central to Italy's energy systems. The country even produces over 50% of its electricity from natural gas. Rome has cut its reliance on Russian gas imports to 25% from about 40% at the start of the year, a decision that has thrown the energy sector into uncertainty. Some analysts have predicted annual gas bills could reach an average of €1,800 next year, almost double the annual average of €950 recorded this year. Many Italians are simply bewildered about how they can find themselves in a position of not being able to heat or light their homes.
It's been this way forever. I used to be a unionist. I saw the crisis coming. This is how our country works. We don't have any sovereignty.
Nothing works in this country. We have forever been in the hands of a bunch of swindlers and criminals. Italy has no future.
The outgoing government is planning to offset its dependence on Russian gas by signing new deals with African and Eastern Mediterranean countries and building new regasification plants in a number of Italian sea towns, a move that has met with staunch opposition from local residents. Max Civili, Rome.
Fighting rages in Ukraine's Donbas region. Russian forces say that they have taken full control of the town of Pisky.
Armed forces of the Russian Federation continue a special military operation in Ukraine. As a result of Russian and pro-Russian forces' advance, Pisky in Donetsk People's Republic has been fully liberated. On an airfield near Domanivka in Mykolaiv region, two Mi-24 helicopters of Ukrainian air forces were destroyed. Russian air defense systems destroyed four Ukrainian drones in the last 24 hours in Kharkiv region.
The Russian Defense Ministry also says its forces have destroyed a U.S.-supplied HIMARS rocket system and an ammunition depot close to the city of Kramatorsk. Capturing Donbas has been the main goal of Moscow since February, when the conflict began in Ukraine. The eastern region is made up of Luhansk and Donetsk provinces, where the conflict has been focused. Luhansk is now almost completely under Russian control, but Ukrainian forces are still holding out in Donetsk. On to France, firefighters there are struggling to contain wildfires that continue to tear through the hillsides in the east. Several rescue groups from other European countries are helping France battle the flames. Fresh wildfires have forced thousands of people to leave their homes in southwestern regions. Over 7,000 hectares of forests and lands have been burnt to the ground. Officials warn that there is still risk of new fires due to high temperatures and a worsening drought. France is struggling with successive heat waves and its worst drought on record. An end to the third heat wave on Sunday is expected to bring some relief to the current situation. Twitter suspends the account of Press TV host and producer Marzia Hashemi in yet another crackdown on the freedom of speech. A message by the platform reads that Hashemi's account was suspended due to breaking Twitter rules. According to the message, Hashemi has also been banned from creating any new accounts on the platform. Marzia Hashemi is the host and producer of Press TV's Hidden Files program. Her last tweet before suspension was about the long history of execution of human rights activists and opposition figures in Saudi Arabia. That was a topic discussed in depth during the latest episode of the Hidden Files program. She joins us now to tell us about her Twitter suspension and a lot more. Marzia Hashemi, welcome.
Thanks so much, Kaveh.
Sure. Well, we gave this intro to your program, but first tell us why you think your Twitter account was suspended. Tell us the circumstances behind it, if you have any idea, that is.
Well, you know, they didn't give me any reason. I have sent a message. I haven't gotten a response yet. It's not the first time, Kaveh, that my Twitter has been suspended, but it's the first time that they've told me that I'm permanently suspended. All I know is that the last tweet that I had written was dealing with Hidden Files, dealing with our latest program, and dealing with the Saudi regime and the execution of over 80 men back in March. Now, it's a story for so many reasons. First and foremost, the number of people who were executed by the regime in one day without the families knowing, families still haven't gotten the bodies back. And another big part of this is how the media is quiet about that. Yes, we're talking about something that happened in March, but we're talking about the massive execution of that many people that the mainstream media has just tried to sweep under the rug. So, as I've said before, those are the files that Hidden Files go after, and we try to highlight this. Now, I don't know exactly if it was the last tweet, but I do know that that's when it was suspended. And what I basically said was just talking about the Saudi regime, how they can get away with anything because of pumping that oil and because of buying all of those weapons and equipment from those Western entities. It doesn't matter, it appears, how many people they killed. Even we're talking about, if we go back to 9/11, the U.S. itself said that the Saudi, at least they didn't say the Saudi regime, but basically Saudi hands were behind that situation. And then we have Khashoggi, who is an American resident, cut to pieces, but still nothing happened. And now we have this mass execution that basically no one is talking about it. And we have seen the relationships just getting warmer and warmer, whether we're talking about with Paris or with Washington or with London. So I was just highlighting once again the Saudi regime and being in cahoots with the Western hegemonic powers. And thus, I am suspended, Kaveh.
Thank you so much for joining us and explaining this to us, Marzia. We
great
appreciate
to be with
it.
You, as always.
It was good to see you. Marzia Hashemi, host of Press TV's The Hidden Files. Moving on to news from Yemen, the Ansarullah movement has held unprecedented military parades in the capital city of Sana'a and other regions. The parades showcase the movement's military capabilities, including tanks, armored vehicles, drones, rockets, and other heavy weaponry. Ansarullah officials say that this way they mean to remind the Saudi-led coalition that if it does not lift the blockade, Yemen will use its power to break the siege. The coalition has stopped attacks on Yemen following a UN-brokered ceasefire that came into force some 4 months ago, but it still maintains a blockade on the country. More than 7 years of the Saudi-led war have devastated Yemen and has led to what the UN has called the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Yemeni activist and political analyst Yusuf Mowry says Yemen's Ansarullah movement is sending several messages to its enemies with these parades.
The first message that they are sending with this display of military parades that have taken place throughout this entire week is that the Sana'a government and the Ansarullah movement, they're fully ready to embrace the art of war and embrace their Yemeni military power in order to defend Yemen and in order to bring about the Yemeni people's demand by ending the 8-year blockade and ending the war on Yemen. That's the first message. The second message that the Ansarullah movement is sending with this military display is, you know, there's a saying here in Yemen, "Ma qadarat min al-jamal illa idhnih," which translates to, you've only seen the tip of the ear of the camel, or you've only seen the tip of the iceberg when it comes to the military power that the Yemeni army possesses. Everything that has been displayed, such as tanks, the armored vehicles, the drones, that's only the weapons that the Ansarullah movement wants the world to see. However, what remains unseen is the fact that they have a sophisticated, state-of-the-art ballistic missile capability that they are not showing to the world. And the only time you see them, you see this military power on display, is in the battlefield itself.
The United States continues to plunder Syria's national resources as it smuggles a fresh convoy of stolen oil into Iraq. According to Syrian media, the convoy contains 89 oil tankers. On Thursday, the U.S. also transferred 144 tankers loaded with stolen Syrian oil to Iraq. According to the Syrian Ministry of Oil and Mineral Resources, the U.S. and militant groups it supports pillaged over 80% of Syria's daily oil production in the first half of 2022. The U.S. maintains nearly 1,000 troops in Syria with the alleged goal of fighting terrorist groups. Syria has time and again condemned the U.S. presence on its soil and the looting of its oil. China is resorting to makeshift hospitals as COVID-19 cases are surging across the Asian nation. The southern province of Hainan has built two makeshift hospitals, and another one is under construction. The province is battling its biggest coronavirus outbreak since the pandemic began. Reported over 1,400 cases on Friday. Officials have placed tight restrictions and lockdowns in the province, which are expected to continue over the weekend. The number of China's total COVID infections for the same day stands at more than 2,100, but the country has reported no new deaths recently. The nation's fatalities stand at around 5,200. Tropical storms lash Japan's main island of Honshu as waves of heavy rains move toward the north. Miri storm is expected to dump nearly 300 millimeters of rain on parts of central Honshu. The Meteorological Agency has issued warnings of mudslides and flooding for Shizuoka, where over 70,000 people are told to evacuate. Warnings on high waves of rainfall and strong storms are also issued for Tokyo and other coastal areas nearby. The storm was formed early on Friday and canceled dozens of flights and caused delays to bullet train services. In an unprecedented move, the FBI searched former U.S. President Donald Trump's residence in Florida earlier this week. Now, a search warrant unsealed by a judge says top secret files were seized from Trump's estate. Trump is accused of violating rules on official record, something he denies. The former president and his Republican allies have accused the FBI of being corrupt and politicized.
The U.S. Justice Department says FBI agents have found 11 sets of classified documents, with some marked as top secret, in Trump's Mar-a-Lago home in Florida while executing a search warrant this week. The warrant was publicly released following a federal judge's order. It states investigators had probable cause to believe Trump violated three federal crimes, including violating the Espionage Act, obstruction of justice, and criminal handling of the government records. Media reports say the FBI search of Trump's Mar-a-Lago home was for possible classified materials related to U.S. nuclear weapons. Trump, however, rejected that. He called it a hoax and claimed he had no stored classified information. The unprecedented raid on the residence of the former U.S. president provoked a backlash from leading Republicans who described the move as politically motivated. The Florida governor, Ron DeSantis, said the search of Trump's property was another escalation in the weaponization of federal agencies against the regime's political opponents. Also, Florida Senator Marco Rubio stated that Biden is using his power to persecute Trump. But the White House has denied the allegations, saying it was unaware of the search before it happened. Moreover, there have been growing threats in recent days against FBI agents and offices across the country. On Thursday, a man who tried to breach the FBI Cincinnati office was shot and killed by police after he fled the scene. Law enforcement officials say the man may have been present at the January 6th riot. Right after news of the FBI search of Mar-a-Lago broke, there was a big spike in tweets referencing civil war. Analysts and reporters say this is alarmingly similar to the activities in the lead-up to the January 6th attack on the Capitol.
Well, I think it's true that there are people in the permanent national security wing of the U.S. government who don't want Trump to return to office. And whether or not those people are currently raiding Trump in Mar-a-Lago in order to try to get proof of crimes they could use to charge him and put him in a position where he legally can't run for office.
And that is it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In Britain, Prime Minister Boris Johnson has waded into the Tory leadership row over energy costs by declaring he's absolutely certain his successor will offer further help to households as annual bills were forecast to top £4,200 by January. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnists Rowena Mason and Alex Lawson. The piece is titled, Johnson Absolutely Certain Next Prime Minister Will Offer More Help on Paying Bills. In Britain, Prime Minister Boris Johnson has waded into the Tory leadership row over energy costs by declaring he's absolutely certain his successor will offer further help to households, as annual bills were forecast to top £4,200 by January. Boris Johnson made an unexpected intervention on energy bills at a Number 10 reception, as Liz Truss, the front-runner to be the next Prime Minister, was accused by Rishi Sunak's campaign of being divorced from reality over her refusal to commit to more handouts. Boris Johnson has repeatedly refused to act on rocketing gas and electricity bills before leaving office on 5th of September, but said he was sure the next Prime Minister will be wanting to make some more announcements in September or October about what we're going to do further to help people in the next period in December and January. He added, I just want you to know that I'm absolutely confident that we will have the fiscal firepower and the headroom to continue to look after people as we've done throughout. The deepening row over how to help households came on the day annual energy bills were forecast to exceed £4,200 from January, triggering a warning that Britons face serious hardship on a massive scale without government intervention. At the same time, government sources have admitted officials have modelled the possibility of a four-day power shortage in the first quarter of next year, potentially requiring rolling blackouts for industry and households. Boris Johnson's comments add further pressure on Liz Truss to acknowledge that, as Prime Minister, she would need to give households more help beyond tax cuts. As Liz Truss doubled down on her plan for reversing the national insurance rise and removing £150 of green levies, a Sunak campaign spokesperson said her proposals will not touch the sides for the majority of British families this winter, and pensioners will get no help whatsoever. The consultancy Cornwall Insight said on Tuesday, 9th of August, that it expected the energy price cap to reach £4,266 a year for the first 3 months of next year, more than triple the level it was at a year previously and more than double the current level. Any shortages of energy over the winter caused by less gas and less electricity from Norway and the rest of Europe could push prices up even further. But Liz Truss said at the weekend that she does not want to give handouts to people struggling with bills, preferring to prioritise tax cuts. She repeatedly refused to promise any further help on energy bills on Tuesday, 9th of August, only confirming plans to reverse the recent increase in national insurance and to temporarily suspend green levies on energy bills. Liz Truss doubled down on her economic stance on Tuesday night by brandishing cash handouts to help with the cost of living as Gordon Brown economics. Speaking at Conservative hustings in Darlington, which was dominated by questions on bills, the Foreign Secretary underlined that she believed the best route to help with the cost of living crisis was cutting taxes, starting with national insurance. Liz Truss said, "I didn't agree with raising national insurance. We promised not to do it in our manifesto, and we need to help those people who are struggling with the cost of living. We need to be on the side of the self-employed. We need to be on the side of people who work and do the right thing, and we need to enable people to keep more of their own money. Those are conservative principles," she said. Liz Truss added, "What I don't support is taking money off people in tax and then giving it back to them in handouts. That, to me, is Gordon Brown economics." Rishi Sunak, in turn, warned that the British people will not forgive us if vulnerable households did not get extra direct help this winter. The former Chancellor Rishi Sunak said Liz Truss's plans would not help swathes of the population and said that whoever was Prime Minister should not rule out direct support. Truss has said she will emphasise tax cuts rather than committing to giving extra direct help with energy bills. "If you're a pensioner, if you're on the National Living Wage, tax cuts are worth zero," the former Chancellor said. "That's not a policy to help people get through the winter, and I think it's wrong to rule out help directly because we as a Conservative government have an obligation to help those who are most vulnerable. If we don't do that, not only will people suffer, but we will get absolutely hammered when it comes to the next election. The British people will not forgive us for not doing that." Critics of her policy warn that tax cuts disproportionately help the better off and offer no assistance to pensioners or those not in work, while the green levies contribute only about £150 annually to the average bill. "What's vitally important at this moment is we get economic growth going," Liz Truss told reporters on a visit to Huddersfield in West Yorkshire. "At the moment, we've got the highest taxes in 70 years, That's why I believe in lower taxes to get economic growth going, to encourage businesses to invest, and that way there will be more money in people's pockets. Asked if she was ruling out any other help for energy bills, Liz Truss replied, "What I am promising is that from day one, people will have lower taxes. They will also have lower energy bills because I'm going to put a temporary moratorium on the green energy levy. But what we need is a growing economy." Meanwhile, Rishi Sunak confirmed in an interview with ITV that he would be likely to offer a few hundreds of pounds in rebates on energy bills after the rise is confirmed. On Monday, 8th of August, the Liberal Democrats called for an energy furlough scheme in which the government financed the complete cost of any rise to the energy price cap in October. While the Labour Party has said it would provide extra assistance to households financed by ending tax breaks for energy firms, one of the party's backbenchers has argued it should go much further. In an article for The Guardian, Zara Sultana said that since Boris Johnson took on board Labour's idea for a windfall tax on energy firms in May, her party isn't offering enough to people struggling with their bills. The Coventry South MP, Zara Sultana, has set up a campaign called Enough is Enough to seek more action on the cost of living.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we will listen to the speech of Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
Dear brothers and sisters in Islam, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. What we want to do this year is to take the words, the stances, the thoughts of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and to take a deeper look at them. We're trying to do a couple of things. One of them is obviously we would like to look at our own current situation, connect the dots, learn from the Imam. But in addition to that, we want to learn from the Imam himself, from his companions. And we have a wide range of things. When we say we want to learn from Imam Hussein, we shouldn't think that this is only going to be about the Qiyam of the Imam, which is just a few months, the whole Qiyam of the Imam. Rather, when we're learning from Imam Hussein, especially with what we have in front of us, we see that we can learn from him from before he became the Imam. We can learn after his imamate. Even when you divide his imamate into two parts, he was there as our Imam and our leader and the leader of the resistance in the time of Muawiyah. There's letters from Imam Hussein to Muawiyah. His stance at that time for us is very important. And then after that, of course, the Qiyam itself, which is unbelievable, and there's so many relevant lessons that we can draw from this. So, what happens is, for us, we kind of approach each Muharram, brothers and sisters, with a sense of urgency. We don't know how many times we have to have these dry runs or practice Muharrams take place before our real test, the living Imam. And what we want to do is we want to have learned those most relevant lessons while there's not live bullets. We want to make sure that we're on the right side of history. When God tests us with the Imam, we're on the right side of history. We've done the right things. We've taken the right stances. The idea of attending these majalis, being here, repeating these things to one another, these truths, attending the masa'ib, repeating the refrains that are there, all of those are to prepare us for our test,
and our imam. So for us, this is very real. Now, what we're going to try and learn about tonight will be learning from some words that our imam said about his companions. Those 72, those 100 and stuff, depending on the narration, those people who made it. There are some very interesting points that we can learn about them. But how we'll start is first seeing how even those companions are relevant for us. How? And this way. If you look at the group of the companions, you'll see that they're a very interesting group of people. Some of the companions are old. Some of the companions are young. Some of the companions knew our imam from his childhood. They grew up with the imam. Other companions, no. They got to meet the imam along the way. Even the ethnic backgrounds of the companions are very different. Their levels of religiosity prior to the advent of Karbala is also very different. You have some of them who knew the imam as a child who've been preparing for this great event, and you had other people who were very new to the path. There's some people who became Shia on the way. They met the imam, then they became Shia. So you look at this diverse group, old, young, some people, even the socioeconomic status of these people was so different. But you do see one thing about these people. The thing about these people is that they passed an incredible test. I hope, brothers and sisters, you realize this, and I'm saying this as a reminder to myself first. We should not think that the test of Karbala was an easy test. That would be a disservice to us, ourselves, to tell us that, oh, it was just a walk in the park. They did the right thing. They saw the imam. No, it was an incredible test. Even though the advent of Karbala had been prophesized, people knew from the time of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam and Amir al-Mu'mineen, they had been told this advent is going to happen. You would think people would have been able to prepare themselves. But no, we found so many people who failed that test. So that comes to tonight's question, which is, what made the companions, and inshallah I want to share the words of the imam about the companions, what made the companions so special? And then if we're trying to look for relevant lessons, we're trying to draw inspiration from this, what do we have to do to be like them? At least to move in that direction. The one thing that we can say about the companions is this. Their faith was incredibly strong. I want to share the actual hadith, but take this from me. Their faith was incredibly strong, such that the imam was able to show them their place in paradise before the battle. That's not normal iman. That's not everyday iman. I would describe their faith, brothers and sisters, as iman which was Ashura'i. Ashura'i. And what I want to talk about is a little bit of that kind of imam. But allow me to talk a little bit about the words of the imam. We'll see where we get the inspiration from. So now I want to share some of the words of the imam about his companions. The imam says this. He says, "Inni la a'lamu ashaban awfa wa khayran min ashabi." Truly, this is now Imam Hussein speaking, the ultimate compliment that any imam can give his followers. I know no companions, no ashab, more loyal and better than my companions. Then he talked about his family. وَلَا أَهْلَ بَيْتٍ أَبَرْ وَأَوْسَلْ مِنْ أَهْلِ بَيْتِ. And I know no family that's more connected, tighter, more dutiful than my family. The imam prayed for them. فَجَزَاكُمُ اللَّهُ عَنِّي خَيْرًا. May Allah bless you on my behalf. The imam praying for these individuals. What happened though, was after that, our imam was very transparent with his companions. He didn't butter them up. He told them, he said that whoever stays with me will definitely be killed. So I know you, you're wonderful, no one better than you, you're loyal, you've passed this test, as I've mentioned. Just understanding what was at stake and how serious this was and the test that they passed, that would take a discussion on its own. Now they pass that test, the Imam gives them the good tidings, he says that you are the best, but then he gives them an out. The Imam said that you are the best, it's not haram now, you can go. Whoever wants to leave, go. Actually, take advantage of the night, leave. Whoever stays is just going to be killed. The companions, to a man, insisted that they would defend the Imam. They showed their loyalty. We would rather be killed. They spoke after that. When they had been given the way out, then the Imam showed them their place in paradise. What Imam Sadiq says is that the veil was removed and they saw their manazil in paradise. They saw their stations in paradise. So now, for us, because we're trying to learn from them, we don't think this happened by magic. There was something they did first, effort they made, and then after that, the Imam saw that readiness, they've done their part, then the Imam steps in, and now then they can see their places in paradise before the battle begins. Iman, which is Ashura'i.
Allahumma ja'al mahyaya mahya Muhammadin wa ala Muhammad wa mamati mamata Muhammadin wa ala Muhammad. To Allah, whenever I face troubles in my life, I close my eyes and see your shrine and call back every time. Oh, Hussein, you're the love of my heart. You are the light of my eyes. I swear to Allah, until my last breath, I will remember Hussein.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
According to the search warrant executed by FBI agents at the former U.S. President Donald Trump's home on Monday, 8th of August, he's under criminal investigation for potential violations of the Espionage Act and additional statutes relating to obstruction of justice and destroying federal government records. We now present you an article written by Julian Borgia. The piece is titled, Nuclear or Not, Classified or Not, Mar-a-Lago Files Spell Out Jeopardy for Trump. Over the course of Friday, 12th of August, the circumstances of recent FBI search of Donald Trump's home at Mar-a-Lago in Florida have come into much sharper focus, which makes them look much worse for the former U.S. president. The unsealed search and seizure warrant shows that it was carried out, in part, under the Espionage Act, a set of statutes dating to 1917 that have been used aggressively to go after leakers, whistleblowers, and the WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. The code quoted in the warrant carries a maximum penalty of 10 years imprisonment. The inventory of material taken out of Mar-a-Lago leaves in no doubt the importance of the documents discovered there. They included top-secret and sensitive compartmented information, meaning there were restrictions on its circulation over and above its top-secret status. It should normally only be in a special facility, a SCIF, a Sensitive Compartmented Information Facility, or SCIF, was established at Mar-a-Lago, but it operated as a secure facility only during the Trump presidency. Altogether, there are 5 sets of top-secret documents listed, 3 sets of secret and 3 sets of confidential documents, as well as binders of photographs and, intriguingly, information about the French President Emmanuel Macron. It was the warrant that was unsealed by court order on Friday, 12th of August, not the supporting affidavit from law enforcement, which would have provided a lot more detail. So there is no confirmation one way or another on the Washington Post report that there were nuclear weapons documents among the trove. Nuclear or not, that is an awful lot of classified stuff, especially in view of the fact that 15 boxes of documents had already been removed in January after discussions between the National Archives and Donald Trump's representatives, and then again in June under a grand jury subpoena. Papers removed on Monday, 8th of August, were held back even after that subpoena, and their continuing presence at Mar-a-Lago was confirmed to the FBI by an informant. In the wake of all that focus on the documents, the possibility that they were retained by accident is extremely small. It also looks significant that, in seeking a court warrant, the FBI did not invoke Code 1924, which is normally used in the case of government employees who hang on to documents they should not have. Instead, the Justice Department used Code 2071 relating to the concealment, removal or mutilation of documentation, and Code 1519 concerning the destruction, alteration or falsification of records in federal investigations. Stephen Vladek, a law professor at the University of Texas, said, "That suggests that the government has reason to believe that President Trump has done more than just hold on to these documents." The Trump defense strategy appears to be twofold. One part is the catch-all claim that anything bad must have been planted by the FBI. That is an extraordinary scorched earth path to take in the absence of any evidence, particularly considering that there has already been an attempt by a Trump supporter on an FBI field office, leading to the attacker being killed by police. It may also be legally untenable, as there appears to have been video footage of the search that was available to Trump's representatives to close circuit television at the time. The Trump camp may not care about that, of course, as long as it muddies the waters. The second strand of the Trump defense, quite contradictory to the first, is that while he was still in the White House, Donald Trump declassified all the material in question by presidential fiat. That would be unusual to say the least, and would not be how declassification is supposed to work. Asher Rangappa, a former FBI agent, special agent, said on Twitter, whatever the president's powers might be to declassify documents, there are good policy and practical reasons for them to follow a process, and for that process to be documented and reflected on the document markings themselves. The Trump Defense Counsel could argue that that is not how Donald Trump rolled. His style was to do things informally. But to a great extent, it is a moot point anyway. The Espionage Act predates the system of classification introduced by executive order after the Second World War, so it makes no reference to it. It talks about national defense information. It does not distinguish between classified and declassified materials, unauthorized retention of any document relevant to the statute remains a crime. However, it is a leap from Donald Trump having a poor legal defense to the prospect of his arrest or criminal charges, steps that would have dramatic political consequences, to say the very least. Although it is called the Espionage Act, it does not necessarily mean that Donald Trump took the documents with the intention of passing them on to a foreign power. The statute also covers more minor offenses. For example, someone who is lawfully in possession of documents, photographs, and so on, and passes them to anyone not entitled to receive it, or fails to hand it over to officials who ought to have it. It can also apply to someone who, through gross negligence, permits the same to be removed from its proper place or custody and fails to report it. Fines can be imposed, and the U.S. Justice Department may be satisfied with getting the second documents back under lock and key. Stephen Vladeck said, I still think an arrest and a prosecution are low probability. From the government's perspective, it seems like at least part of this exercise was about just removing things from President Trump's possession, and that's been accomplished, whereas arresting him and prosecuting him raise a whole different slew of political complications. One of three statutes cited in the search warrant, Code 2071, contains a clause stating that anyone who willfully and unlawfully conceals, removes, mutilates, obliterates, falsifies or destroys government documents shall be disqualified from holding any office under the United States law. Here again, Stephen Vladeck is skeptical over whether this can be enforced for this kind of offense. Vladeck said, there are questions about whether Congress can disqualify someone from the presidency through such a statute. He added, I think there would be a serious constitutional challenge to Congress's power to disqualify the statute unrelated to the 14th Amendment, unrelated to the insurrection. According to the search warrant executed by FBI agents at Donald Trump's home on Monday, 8th of August, he's under a criminal investigation for potential violations of the Espionage Act and additional statutes relating to obstruction of justice and destroying federal government records. The search warrant, that the contents of which were confirmed by The Guardian, shows the FBI was seeking evidence about whether the mishandling of classified documents by Donald Trump, including some marked top secret, amounted to a violation of three criminal statutes. Most probably, the search warrant authorized FBI agents to seize materials from Donald Trump's residence to investigate crimes in connection with the Espionage Act, which outlines the unauthorized retention of national security information that could harm the United States or aid an adversary. The other statutes listed on the search warrant include the federal law that makes it a crime to destroy or conceal a document in order to obstruct a government investigation, and a federal law that prohibits the unlawful removal of government documents more generally. The inclusion of the obstruction statute could be an indication that the Justice Department is investigating Donald Trump not just over the potentially unlawful retention of records, but also whether he attempted to impede the separate or wider criminal inquiry. The disclosures, which came in an attachment to the search warrant, mark a dramatic escalation in the U.S. Justice Department's criminal inquiries into Donald Trump. They represent perhaps one of the most treacherous legal and political moments faced to date by the former president. A conviction for violating any of the detailed laws would be severe. The Espionage Act has a maximum penalty of 10 years in federal prison, and the statute for obstruction has a maximum penalty of 20 years in prison, while the statute for destruction of records can also bar anyone convicted from holding future office.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The leader's viewpoint on Imam Hussein's revolution and Ashura. If this battle had not taken place in Karbala, we would not be aware of the principles of Islam to the extent we are today. And there was probably just a nominal trace of Islam. Not only were this great event and the holy blood of the martyrs not undermined, but they also gained more prominence in history. This is an outstanding example. Everyone was wondering what had happened on the day of Ashura, the greatness of the event, the greatness of the jihad done by the Prophet's loved one and his companions was not known to anyone. neither was the magnitude of the catastrophe in which the Holy Prophet's sons and loved ones were martyred. The majority of those who were present in the battle did not recognize the importance of this issue. And those who were fighting for the enemies were so ignorant and unaware that they did not realize what had happened. Those enchanted by ignorance, lust, and animal urges cannot understand what is happening in the human world. Of course, Sayyida Zainab salamullah alayha sukaina, and those innocent girls and women did recognize the magnitude of the event. This is what happened on the day of Ashura.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The story didn't just end in the afternoon of Ashura. In fact, since the afternoon of Ashura, a movement started in history, which is still growing and expanding. It will be the same in the future too. Imam Hussein alayhi salam did all in his power to proclaim the word of truth and to save the people. These are some of the traits that a person in general can see and show in the Ashura event. Some events are forgotten over time, like a weak wave created by throwing a pebble in a pool of water. There is a wave, but as the time passes, it becomes weaker every moment and fades away in a short time. But there are events the other way around. They do not fade away over time. Rather, time makes them more important. One example is the event of Ashura. Those who are not familiar with Islam, but understand the concepts of freedom, justice, dignity, elevation, and lofty human values, consider Imam Hussein alayhi salam as the imam in seeking freedom, in seeking justice, and the fight against viciousness and against ignorance and human degradation.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.